COVID-19 has cost lives and delivered a sudden blow to the economy that few could have imagined. Business leaders are having to rethink how they operate to take care of their customers and keep their people safe. But as we adapt to doing business in the context of the pandemic, the threat of climate change continues to grow. I'm Alana Weston, chairman of Selfridges Group, and I believe that sustainability will be the next big disruptor of my industry. It must be placed at the heart of business strategy if we're to overcome the climate crisis and transition to a cleaner and more just economy. And that's why I'm sharing this podcast. In each episode, I'll be asking an inspirational thinker to share with me their insight into how business can transform itself to create a sustainable future for us all. Today, you'll hear my conversation with one of the icons of sustainable leadership, Paul Polman, former CEO of Unilever. In 2010, he launched Unilever's audacious sustainable living plan, designed to decouple growth from their environmental footprint while increasing positive social impact. In many ways, Paul set the standard for how large organizations can make sustainability central to their mission. And despite countless obstacles, it has been an enormous success. Before we dive into my conversation with Paul, I should mention that we were speaking back in 2019, well before the pandemic. Although the world has changed since then, the principles Paul shared around running a sustainable business still hold true. So to start with, I wanted to get a sense of how he sees himself as an activist, a business leader, or both.
I think you have to be both nowadays. In fact, when I retired, Bloomberg and the New York Times described me as an activist CEO, and I didn't know if I should have been happy or not about it. But the reality is now employees, about 65% of their employees in your companies, expect CEOs to speak up and have an opinion about issues that are relevant to the business, not everything, but relevant to the business. And in fact, society expects the same. 85% of society expects CEOs now to speak up. We're in a very difficult time from a geopolitical point of view. Mm-hmm. Issues are not being addressed, and I think the private sector has that responsibility.
From the point of view of climate change or environmental issues, supply chains for businesses such as Unilever and also Selfridges are very, very complicated. And often people in head office and customers aren't so aware of where things come from. How were you able to make that transparency within the business provide energy for some of the change you wanted to make?
Well, the first thing is really a philosophy that is linked to this multi-stakeholder model. You know, you are there for your employees, for your suppliers, for your communities, for the customers you serve. Many companies stay in the CSR space, corporate social responsibility, which basically deals with their factories, their travel, things under their control. But I've always said, and from the beginning when I entered Unilever, you cannot outsource your supply chain, which we all do, and at the same time outsource your responsibilities. Yeah. That doesn't work, you know? So if you're in the food business, like we are partly as Unilever, then you also have to deal with the issues of subsistence farming, stunting, food waste, deforestation, and on the other hand, obesity, because you're part of that value chain. If we produce irresponsibly, and increasingly consumers are aware of it in this age of transparency that we're living in, we are held accountable for that. Now, interestingly, it's actually one of the biggest business opportunities that is around. And so you don't have to present it as a threat. You have to present it as an opportunity. And it can unlock enormous energy. When we started working with our suppliers, we have 80,000 suppliers. We change about 20,000 suppliers a year. It's impossible to audit them all. So you have to get them up to standards of behavior and hope that they actually live it. And it's not only environmental. When I talk environmental for us, it also means human rights to ensure that there are fair wages, mm-hmm. that there is no slave labor or child labor or bonding and all the other things that come with it. What we found was that as we work closer, especially with our top 100 suppliers, which were about 70% of our procurement, that you find tremendous opportunities. There's never been a compromise. The business gets better, the people get more motivated, costs get taken out, efficiencies get driven in, and that you then invest in doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And if you have that courage to not bring it just immediately to the bottom line and give it all to your shareholders, but manage a little bit that flexibility that you have, just like we do on all the other things in business. You actually can create stronger ties with your suppliers and better, more robust supply chains. I believe at the end of the day, and you start to see that happen already, consumers will want to know where their products come from. Blockchain will obviously help and other technologies that are coming in. But if you soon buy packets of tea, you want to know the tea bush it comes from, the people have been treated properly, if it's done sustainably, if taxes have been paid, if you fight against corruption, if you provide decent housing for the people or sanitation. And that is becoming an increasingly more important driver for brand choice.
I mean, one of the things we talk about in our business is about creating a safe place to shop,
yeah,
because it is so complicated for people.
Yeah.
And to be able to go to one place and know that somebody else has checked as best they can to understand, yeah, where things have come from and who made them. How much value do you think that can add to an individual brand or an overall group?
Oh, enormously. And it really boils down to the word trust that comes to mind as I hear you talk, you see. And there is an enormous lack of trust in institutions, in companies, in CEOs. And one of the things when we came out with the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, which had as a very simple objective to decouple our growth from environmental impact, to increase our overall social impact. So basically a positive footprint, not easy to do. Green energy, zero waste in our factories, all these things, human rights standards. But we put 50 targets out there. And by putting this transparency out there, these 50 targets, reporting on them every year,
mm-hmm,
we actually created trust, you know. Trust comes from transparency, and that's the basis for prosperity, ultimately. And it's difficult to do. Some things can be measured, some things cannot be measured. But at the end of the day, because of that, created a understanding with all of our stakeholders, not only the consumers, but the NGO community, civil society, etc., that became a partnership that was stronger than we had ever thought, actually.
It's interesting what you say about transparency, because in the luxury business, the mystery has always been a part of the sort of specialness of luxury, and trying to shift that towards transparency being a value is an interesting process. How did you make your teams feel comfortable with being transparent when maybe they weren't perfect yet?
Well, in order to put an audacious plan like this in place, you have to create the right environment. So the first thing I did in Unilever was we stopped giving quarterly reporting, we stopped giving guidance, we moved our compensation really to the long term, put skin in the game so that people felt the ownership.
Mm.
And then internally, getting your own employees on board. If the employees don't feel comfortable when they get attacked about the plastic that is around your products or the deforestation that is in your value chain or some of the human rights issues that you always have to deal with, they have to feel good about that. So I spent a lot of time reading the history of the company. And what I found was the origin of these companies, the way Lord Lever intended it, not different from the Cadburys or the Rowtrees or many others, was really this model that had to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Lord Lever already called it shared prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
He built houses for its people in Port Sunlight. He guaranteed a six-day work week. When World War I came, he guaranteed the jobs back and paid the salaries to the wives that were left behind. And so what I was fortunate enough to do in Unilever, built on these values that were, mm-hmm, already there, but now firmly link them to the business and to the brands, firmly make them our operating model. It is the strategy. It's not an add-on or a nice to do.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we do,
mm-hmm,
and make it clear that it gets embedded. We introduce what we call the compass and a Unilever Sustainable Living Plan. And we put in there very firmly that we are there for the multiple stakeholders. And only by doing that well, will the shareholders benefit. So we made that an outcome, not an objective, for example. And we had to shift quite drastically our organization from one that was focused on negotiating price and,
yeah,
and frankly, not worrying about quality and producing standard products. And, you know, the KPIs were just wrong in that, mm-hmm, sense, to really starting different relationships with our suppliers based on innovation, based on joint development of products, and just really, really changed that drastically. And that required quite a lot of things, you know. Instead of having to fill out 200 pages on our websites to even be able to deal with us, You know, we made it one or two pages. Instead of getting paid in 120 days, we made that 45 days and we paid on time. And so we made some signals there that we wanted to be different. We created a partner to win event with the top 100 suppliers that we're doing every year, where we literally expose them to our thinking and make them part of our innovation processes. And the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, it motivates employees. It gets a high engagement, takes costs out, it drives innovations faster. Frankly, there are very few downsides.
And I guess that structuring the business around a sort of mutually beneficial ecosystem is probably the right culture to deliver sustainable growth.
Oh, absolutely. And with the pace of change that we have right now and the complexities of issues that need to be solved, you just can't do it alone anymore. In fact, one of the most brilliant things that came in by coincidence when we put out this Unilever Sustainable Living Plan with these audacious targets is that we said two things. First, we said we don't have all the answers, which was kind of unique to hear that from a CEO because, you know, hubris-ness is probably one of the traits. And we were kind of modest about that, which sort of made us vulnerable in a positive way. And the second thing we said was we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. And that created an enormous partnership. And any of the big projects that created breakthroughs in the company that ultimately drove it to higher success came from these strong partnerships. And these were partnerships with governments, with civil society, with our suppliers. The African proverb that says, if you want to go fast, you go alone. If you want to go far, you go together, really holds as well for business.
When you launched the Sustainable Living Plan, I had just heard of the word sustainability. Right. And we'd been doing it anyway with Project Ocean, but I didn't know that it had a name. I just knew that I wanted to try to use the Selfridges voice to agitate around endangered fish. So we had gone public before we had our house in order, quite frankly. Right. But I was fascinated that you were putting your head above the parapet, so to speak, because there was such an anxiety at that time around greenwash and people saying things they didn't mean or doing things for marketing reasons. How important was it that you spoke publicly about these targets rather than keeping them in-house?
On the greenwashing itself, there's still a lot of that going on there, and we know that. And that's now around purpose. It's around sustainability. I've always said there's a difference between corporate social responsibility and responsible social corporations. And I think we need to move now everybody towards these responsible social corporations, just like you do. And increasingly, CEOs need to speak up, not only actually to communicate with your employees. It's incredibly effective, actually, to have your article in a newspaper. Somehow your employees believe you more when you're in The Economist than if you talk to them directly. So there's a commitment that actually helps, but also a commitment towards society. And what we were very careful about is not communicating actually the good things what we were doing. We were actually very careful in our communication on what we thought needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's a different type of communication. Mm-hmm. And you do it authentically. I actually shied away from the media training or the PR departments or anybody around me to polish up these things. And people were nervous around that. And some of these targets indeed were audacious. We said we would reach, for example, 1 billion people and improve their health and well-being. At that time, we were doing hand washing and oral care was about 50 million people. After 10 years, we achieved about 800 million people. So we fell short of our target, you might say, but because we put the billion target out there, we moved from 50 million, that took us about 50 years to achieve, to 800 million in about 10 years' time. So I'm very much into these audacious targets. And then if you explain that to people, what you're trying to achieve, people will obviously buy into that, even if you don't hit these numbers exactly. It's a philosophy that we're talking about here.
It's a philosophy and a mindset, isn't
it? It's a mindset, absolutely.
And it shifts the mindset. I feel if you go incrementally, the mindset doesn't shift. It just gets added onto whatever they were doing before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas if you absolutely change direction, everybody has to wake up.
I totally agree. It's the same as running marathons. We've all done that. You first have to tell it to as many friends as possible. Then you have to run it with a buddy, which is partnership, so you don't let him down. And then ideally, you run it for a good cause, because if you don't even want to chicken out, some people are going to die. And business is not different. You tell people what you want to do, you do it in partnership, and you do it for a good cause.
How did you get the right team around you? Did you find that they came naturally because of that meaningful approach?
Well, there is no doubt that the generations that are coming up now are much more purpose-driven than we were, and they're much more aware of these situations and actually see them positively in terms of trying to find these solutions. Whilst we sort of feel guilty on the problems we give them, they're actually embracing them and very creatively attacking them. But they want to work for a company that does more than just pay them a salary. They want to leave this world in a little bit better place than they found it. So when we started the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, quite quickly we saw that we became the third most looked up employer on LinkedIn after Google and Apple. And we are not even a brand name by itself, but we had 2 million people applying to us every year. And in most countries that we operate, which is in about 190 countries in the world, we became the preferred employer.
And what do you think was the most difficult aspect of delivering the plan?
There are probably two or three challenges that take more time than I thought. First, when we did the plan, we looked at the situation coming out of the financial crisis. Most companies were hunkering down, were cutting costs. Fortunately, our company had gone down for 10 years, so my remit for which I was hired was to grow the business. So I was actually in a moment of investing in the business when others seemed to retract. And I think the financial crisis, to me, brought to life two things. The first one is that a system of overconsumption and high levels of government and private debt, or a system where we leave too many people behind or make these people feel that they not participate, ultimately will rebel against itself. I've said it 10 years ago, and we're still in that cycle trying to get out of it. And then the second thing, how difficult it is to move systems when you also depend on the political environment and others. It's just difficult. You can talk to any company now in the world, in any industry, and they will put a nice report in front of you and explain eloquently all the things that they're doing. But the reality is, collectively, it still doesn't add up. Governments nowadays need to hear the voice of business and permission of business to make changes before they actually take the risk to do them. Mm-hmm. In Paris, there were more business people than politicians during the COP21, and that's why we got a fairly, you know, reasonable agreement at that time, much better than people thought. Not enough, but much better than people thought, because business spoke up.
I come from a family business, so the long term is the natural thing. But at the same time, I feel the sense of urgency because we only have 10 years. And as we know in business, we're used to 5-year plans. And so to write your 5-year plan now,
difficult.
It's difficult, but also it feels like it's too long. And that actually what we need to try to do is to disrupt ourselves before sustainability disrupts us. How can we get the culture, the people, the processes in place to mean that we can change faster?
We should be more courageous. We should be braver as leaders. And so what we now need to do is rise above that challenge, be adults, put the interest of the common good ahead, put the coalitions together that can do something about it, and get enough people that are driven by that stronger sense of purpose. I found that it doesn't need many. You can create tipping points in any industry around any topic by getting the right 20, 30 people in the room. And then you can move about 20, 30% of a market. Politicians get interested. Competition wants to then be part of it. You get rid of the free riders. You get some rules, laws, or regulations or frameworks around it to move it faster.
We both come from a consumer business, and the dinner party conversation is often about, well, we can't consume as so much. There's not room. It doesn't matter how great the sustainable cotton is or whatever we're selling. We need to buy less. How do you answer that question as you're seeking growth in new markets or in existing markets?
With the issues that we face, we now actually need to find a growth pattern where we use less things. And part of that can be done by innovation. For example, in the music industry, you can get your energy from green energy now. You can get your music digitally. You don't have to produce the CDs yeah. or the big records anymore. So you stopped your resource use to some extent and you can make it sustainable. So you can redesign the model. If you're in the fashion business, you need to look at that as well. What does it mean? You know, is it really right to have 52 seasons during the year? Is it really right to have such a high scrap rate coming out of that? Is it really right to define luxury by buying more clothes that you hardly use? So people are starting to think differently about this consumption pattern. So can we design something for fashion that is as value creating, even more satisfying, that consumers are certainly willing to pay for and participate in, but that doesn't use as much material? So we have to get out of that notion of we need to dig in the earth, stuff it in a factory, and dump it in the landfills and in oceans, because that simply isn't going to work anymore. Nature doesn't have waste. Waste was invented by human beings. So if human beings invented waste, you can also invent yourself out of it.
So your new venture is called Imagine. How important is imagination to solving these problems? And where can we get the talent and also the mindset to imagine our way out of this trouble?
Well, obviously, without dreaming where you need to be, it's very difficult to get there. It starts there. It obviously came from the Beatles song. But what we said was, you look at what is happening in this world as we are working within the current system, doing baseline management, incrementalism. And it's just not getting the speed and scale with which we are moving is just not good enough. We think the private sector has a key role to play and is the biggest catalyzer for change right now in the moment that we are in history. So we're looking at fashion for good. We're looking at travel and tourism for good. We're looking at tech for good. We're looking at finance for good. And we're looking at food for good. And in these five sectors, you cover about 80% of the sustainable development goals.
And so how will it work?
So you take the fashion industry, if I may go directly to your industry, because that might be more relevant for the people listening. It's a big role that fashion plays in society. And the industry does a lot of good. It has discovered also that there are some practices it needs to change. You have your Fashion for Good initiatives coming from all different sides, but collectively it doesn't add up. It's actually the second most polluting industry in the world. So what we attempt to do then is to create a neutral space. We find some heroic CEOs, bring these CEOs together first. Then we try to bring in the others, about 30% of your value chain, and we put them in a room and we have a common platform. In this case, in a relatively short period of time, for the first time, this industry with 32 CEOs, 30% of the total value chain, was able to come with some quite reasonable targets around climate change, commitments around plastics and moving out of single-use plastics, and commitments to look at regenerative agriculture, especially around cotton production. This is probably the first time that the industry got together and did a commitment of that magnitude. It was on the agenda of the G7. All the heads of states were pleased with that. It actually gives politicians courage. Since that happened and it got some publicity, I've had other companies call me and say, why weren't we part of that? Now that we have this 30%, we're starting to attract the others, and I think we can create some critical mass. What it now needs is this neutral space where the CEOs can come together, where they make a commitment for about 5 years, where we put some structure around that for implementation, sharing, accountability, but also injecting new ideas to drive it faster. And I'm convinced that with the right CEOs there, we can actually create these tipping points. So that's what we now need to see. Can we get to that next level? The first level was already very good, but it actually was the easiest level. To some extent, although we should be proud of what we have achieved in this short period of time. But now the rubber hits the road. And, you know, this society is long on words and short on action. And now we need to get long on action and short on words.
Thank you, Paul. I think we can leave it there because we're all for the action. Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Paul, please remember to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave us a review and share it with anyone you think might find this series valuable. This episode was brought to you by Selfridges Group and Radio Wolfgang. The producers were Ivor Manley, Natalia Rodriguez, Cormac McAuliffe, and Eli Block. The production manager was Katie Fuller, and the executive producer was Harry Watson. Thank you once again to Paul Polman. I'm Alana Weston, and this is How to Lead a Sustainable Business.